What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, our new weekly Gaelic football show.
Lads, it's official, right? No GAA player was practicing tackling at all during lockdown. They were practicing that dummy bounce.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, you're very welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown, the podcast that looks at the stats, XG and performance of Celtic FC. If you missed our season ender podcast with the 20-Minute Tims, you can get that over on their Patreon page, it's 20-Minute Tims. We're going to be doing something similar here today, except we're going to be taking a more broad look at the club and how the club performed over the course of the season and judging whether or not it was a good or bad season. I'm pretty sure we know the answer to that already. But there is breaking news, and if you've been listening to the podcast over the last couple of weeks, you would have heard us saying multiple times, Eddie Howe is not confirmed yet. Well, the news is, as of today, that the Eddie Howe deal has collapsed. That's according to the Daily Mail. Eddie Howe will not be the next Celtic manager after months of talks. And Celtic are now 2 weeks away from pre-season training with no manager, despite getting rid of Neil Lennon in February of this year. So, Al Morrison, Celtic Bank Numbers, and Jaco James. It's been a fun day. It's never a dull day when it comes to Celtic. It's never
happy
been
Friday.
Happy Friday to all the Celtic fans out there. Alan, your thoughts on this? I mean, it's embarrassing, really.
Yeah, it is. Just when you thought it couldn't get worse, right? I mean, it's just astonishing, frankly.
Haven't we been saying that all season? How can it get worse?
Yeah, and it's gone beyond coincidence, right? You know, decision making at the top level within the club. And this is now the apex of it, a situation where, as you said, a manager was sacked in February. We're now 2-3 weeks, call it, away from pre-season training, 3 months later. And suddenly a deal which everybody seemed confident was going to happen. I mean, I was actually personally quite confident, and the basis of my confidence wasn't some superb in the knownness. It was actually the absence of chatter about anybody else. There wasn't much talk or rumour or about any other person being approached or being in the frame or any suggestion that things were going wrong. And if as it seems, it's down to the inability for Howe to get the backroom staff that he wanted, I just find that an astonishing situation, because, you know, anybody that's done any recruitment at any level, you know, when you look someone in the eye, when you meet someone in the room, you know, and you get you sense what their motivators are, especially for a senior executive position like this. You talk to people, you get the background, you know, not just from you know, Howe himself, but also the people that he wants to bring in, because they're clearly a key dependency on getting the deal over the line. And for it to drag on this long and no one to have either twigged or if Celtic have just played along on in the hope that it'll all work out all right, it's just negligent, because it's, you know, you the football, there's 100,000 managers out there in the world. There's plenty of people that, you know, could potentially do a good job at Celtic. If you can't get the deal over the line, set a time frame and then move on. Don't wait. You've now risked another season. You've now put in jeopardy automatic Champions League qualifications. Think about that. Never mind the fact that the first engagement for the new manager is going to be a very difficult Champions League qualifier. So it's just the thinking behind this. It's not loyalty. It's not decisiveness to say, we picked our guy and we're going to, you know, stand by at hell high water. It's poor business judgment. Simple as that.
I should actually clarify as well that Celtic didn't sack Neil Lennon. I've just been saying that they've sacked him because it feels like they should have sacked him, but he actually resigned. So if anybody wants to tweet us angrily, we know he resigned, but he more or less was sacked. Like, that's essentially what it came to. One of the candidates for Celtic's job at the start was Enzo Maresca. He actually got the Parma job last night. It was confirmed. But what this confirms to me for Celtic is that they didn't have a plan for post Neil Lennon. They didn't start talking to people before Neil Lennon was gone. They waited until he was gone and then started recruiting a new manager, and it's still taken this long to get them. So again, your lack of foresight from Celtic's point of view in that angle. And then for this, it's just like, if the manager wants someone, you get them who he wants. And it's the levels that Neil Lennon was operating under that he was not going to get a bigger job than Celtic. So he was more than happy to take this job without getting his own backroom team. But if you want someone with the CV and the stock of Eddie Howe, you need to go out and get him who he wants to bring to the club. And that seems to be what the falling off point of this deal is and why it's fallen apart. James, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm as far as breaking news goes, I was doing yard work just this Friday morning my time on a holiday weekend. So this is Memorial Day weekend in the U.S. So I was out doing yard work, came back in, jumped in a cold shower, so I didn't look quite as flush as I usually do. And so you guys broke the news to me actually just before we went live. So the reason why I'm not looking at the camera even more so than usual is because I'm looking over here and trying to catch up on all of the breaking news. It's completely unsurprising to me. The amount of incompetence that's been on display this season has been stunning. I mean, just stunning. I've in my post-Ferenc Faros thread, I talked about how risk tends to unfold in a nonlinear way in a feedback loop, right? And again, this gets into technical stuff I won't get into specifically, but the idea that chaos starts to ensue is pretty normal when you get the kind of pent up risk factors that we had. And one of the big levers here is people's brains break. You know, they literally go into things like cognitive dissonance, and the ability to make good, sound decisions in the midst of high pressure is very difficult. And this has been, you know, a series of bad decisions that has unfolded really since August, because number one, I think the people in charge have had inflated sense of self. I've called it the misattribution problem, which is, you know, because of the domestic success in Scotland, there's been all of this kind of, I call it faux dominance, right? So we've been dominating over a league that didn't really have a huge amount of competition, and we've won a lot of trophies, yes. But there's a reason why the barometer in Europe has been so poor, and it's because the club has not been run well in the last, relatively speaking, meaning that if you look at relative to what's going on in the industry, in this modernization wave that's taken place in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've been woeful. And this is reflective of senior management that does not understand the industry that they're taking part in at this point. The fact that a manager was at the center of the rebuild is the biggest example of that. I've been harping about this since February, basically, when this first started to, you know, the talk of Howe, and really the first talk of far as Harkin maybe being the target and director of football in this restructure. So I think, like 10 in a row, they came into this season with a plan. The plan was, we were going to win 10 in a row, and then John Kennedy was going to be the next manager. And it was going to be this nice, orderly passing of the baton from Neil Lennon to John Kennedy. And, you know, you'd have Nicky Hammond running football operations, and everything was going to be fine. And then all of this risk boiled up, chaos ensued, and the level of decision-making has been a disaster within that context. Completely unsurprising to me. Mm-hmm. And maybe for different reasons. My thought the whole time was that it didn't make any sense that Howe would come to Celtic and have to answer to a director of football like Harkin. But if it, you know, if it was the support staff, backroom staff not willing to move up into Glasgow, you know, who knows? But the whole fact that this has all been built around a manager, like a Brendan Rodgers 2.0 attempt, is, to me, was, you know, reflective of archaic ideas and poor management.
Having you know, mooted the notion that a director of football was going to be appointed, and then not to appoint that person, and then to build everything around a manager who seemingly is insistent on having specific backroom staff. It's just, it's all the wrong way around. You know, that you've got to have a strategy to begin with, and then you've got to deliver on your strategy, and you do that in an orderly way. You'd surely get your director of football in first, and then you'd think about what are the structures we need to make the operation, football operation, successful. There's no evidence any of that is happening. It's just lip service. It's just sticking a title on somebody. I mean, that's a nonsense, right?
Yeah. Well, if you're getting a director of football, then he's a guy who is in search of the first team coach, not Dermot Desmond. So that's, you need the director of football working with the manager, working with the head coach. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. So it would be literally lip service to that title for Fergal Harkin if Eddie Howe was coming in with all of his own staff anyway, because he wouldn't want to be working under a director of football. He'd want to be the guy bringing in his players. And that's just not how that system works.
Well, and that's what I've been saying for months now. It's to me, it didn't make any sense for either of Howe or Harkin to accept the reality of working at a club that's, you know, let's call it run by Dermot Desmond, who seems to have been active. You know, we've discussed this before, the fact that Desmond was talking to Lennon regularly, that's never a good sign. particularly because Desmond's shown himself not to be, you know, he's not the guy that runs Brentford, the owner at Brentford, you know? So the ideas that he laid out in that Athletic article interview back in September, I mean, it was just shocking, some of the stuff. I mean, like 1950s type of thinking in certain things. So why would Harkin come with that power struggle? Why would Howe come? You know, it never made sense to me relative to the dynamics. This goes back to also, I mean, the idea that Eddie Howe was some kind of savior, or even a Rodgers 2.0, I think was silly. So for them to have identified him as the manager type to be willing to sacrifice structural reforms and really building for the future, you know, from what I've done on my own research and analysis, I mean, Howe looks like a good manager, but you know, most of that excellence was done just as the industry was starting to change rapidly. And
good enough that you basically piss away 3 months.
Exactly. No.
Nobody is, right? Nobody that Celtic are going to get.
That's the point. Yeah. Risk. It's not like Conte's walking through the door, or, you know, it's somebody that's, you know, has a proven track record of making major differences in as a manager, meaning that making decisions in a really effective way where they, you know, really drive performance upgrades. So I never understood it. It didn't make sense. And now, you know, I guess now they'll scramble to install Harkin, because now I would think the equation is going to tilt towards Harkin being the power center. I'd be shocked if that doesn't get announced quickly, because the PR on this is going to be a disaster. And then whether they, you know, they're going to install somebody else, I would think, relatively quickly, whoever that might be, you know, who the rumors are flying. Again, that's what I was looking over. The national coach of Australia's, and you mentioned Patrick Vieira. I mean, I
really hope it's not Patrick Vieira. Patrick Vieira is just a Roy Keane, but former Arsenal. Like, this is what this is for me is just embarrassing, because, I mean, we probably should have been worried when the club were tweeting about season tickets and are saying that we had hoped to have a manager installed by this point. I retweeted it with the picture of the guy protesting, saying our expectations were low, but holy fuck. Like that's where I'm at with Celtic. Like every single time I'm like, I had no, you've destroyed my standards, but I'm still surprised by how badly you've done this. So that's where we're at with the manager situation. We might have a manager in the next 2 weeks before the season actually starts. So we might return to that and do a pod once a manager is actually installed, because we do want to talk about the season. And I suppose this decision, this Eddie Howe situation, it sums up exactly why this season was such a shit show in the first place, because the planning, the cohesion within the entire structure of Celtic Football Club is just a mess. So I guess we'll start with the very start of the season, and that's transfers. So Celtic brought in Barkas for Nets. They made sure they kept Odson Edouard for another year. El Yunusi stayed at the club for another year. There wasn't a huge amount of ins and outs. It was essentially they brought in a couple of players to help them towards the 10-0, but I know that both of you were not very impressed with the signings because of the idea around the structure and the team and the formation. So I guess we'll start there, Alan. What were the warning signs for you when Celtic were buying in for the new season?
So the concern was obviously the sort of spine of the team, and it was starting from the goalkeeper, right? So Forster had been a hugely influential figure for the team. He'd arguably been the difference between Europa League qualification and not, and arguably, I don't even know if it's arguable, to be fair, he won the League Cup, and all of the good feeling that brings and the momentum that brings to the side. And clearly, you know, he was a player who, as the games got bigger, he seemed to perform at a higher level. And so it was obvious as well that Lennon wanted Forster back. And it looked like, you know, with his situation at Southampton, he'd go back, he would be on the bench again. Is that really where he wanted to be? All the mood music I heard was, again, he's very happy. He loves Celtic. He loves working with Steve Woods. Therefore, you know, surely something could be worked out. And for whatever reason, that never happened. And it seemed like we were kind of on the back foot on that fundamental position. And we end up, rather than accepting the fact that given that Forster has been third choice at Southampton in the time, you know, there are probably a lot of goalkeepers that are pretty decent, right? Sitting around, kicking around football, not being used. Do you need to go and spend $5 million on a goalkeeper? I don't think so. I think you could probably pick one up from La Liga or the English Premier League or anywhere who's you know, not figuring in the first team, who's keen to make a move. I mean, the guy that Aston Villa signed, is it Martinez? It was at Arsenal forever on the bench, and then suddenly became a hero in the cup run, and then had a good season for Villa. There's bound to be other players like that knocking about, and it never felt like Lennon was bought into Barkas, and that was what concerned me. He never even started first game of the season. Bain was in goal, and then Barkas was in goal, and it just smacked of indecision from day one, and through, you know, that was the goalkeeper situation. We then, you know, looked at the other pieces. The other warning signs for me was Edouard staying, because, you know, it felt like it was probably on the back of a fantastic season, and with 2 years left on his contract, would be the classic moment to cash in, and for me, that I would have, you know, been perfectly happy with that. I don't want to lose Edouard, but let's be sensible here. He's not going to be Callum McGregor. He's not going to be here in 6-7 years time, right? The guy's going to go and play for a top side, and Celtic could have got a lot of money for him, and that money would have then, you know, bought two or three really good players. You know, we did well with Julien, we did well with Edouard in when we bought him. These are the two recent examples where Celtic have spent, you know, the two record transfer deals, and they both paid off. We've got what we paid for. Could have bought another couple of players of that ilk. So this whole sort of keeping the squad together piece sounded great. Sounded like, oh, the Celtic are really committing and going all in here. But actually, at the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, do they really want to be here? I mean, you know, if they've been told we're not selling you at any cost, that's not going to be a motivator as such, I don't think. So the transfer, in assessing the transfers, I was as concerned with the transfers that didn't happen as much as the ones that did. And then as we, you know, we spent a lot of money on players, actually. You know, Barkas was around 5 million, 4.5. Adjeti was the same. And Adjeti, you know, was a player languishing in English reserves. He'd got a bit of a run at West Ham, never really scored many goals for them. They thought he was decent. He's young, which was good. But again, it wasn't obvious how he fitted into any particular style of play, especially as we also had Klamala, which is another signing that never made any sense for the way that Celtic play. And then Turnbull was brought in a year after, recovering from a long operation, but at least he started to play again for Motherwell. But then we didn't see him for 6 months, as if, again, Lennon didn't trust him. So those transfers felt like, and actually Adjeti, to come back to Adjeti and Klamala, they actually played a fair few minutes in the early games of the season, mainly as substitutes, but they came on, they both scored, and you know, strikers breed on confidence, breed on scoring goals, and then suddenly they weren't trusted anymore. Mm. And there was just no cohesion or thinking seeming to running through those transfers. And then it just got worse and worse. I mean, bringing El Yunusi back kind of made sense. He'd done okay. He came back and he actually improved. He was one player who probably improved over the season, year on year. But then, you know, the sort of panic buys at the end of the elongated transfer window that ran into the end of September was to bring in, after Julian had a couple of injuries, was to bring in Duffy and Laxall. And that absolutely just killed the structure of the defence and just completely the wrong players for the way that Celtic play. So, you know, all in all, the transfers were just... we use the word incoherent a lot. They were so bad that I've seen many people on Twitter and so forth saying, oh, we should never have got rid of Hayes and Simunovic and Craig Gordon. I mean, it's got to be pretty bad where your cognitive dissonance kicks in to such an extent you think keeping those guys would have been a good idea. But that's how bad it was.
Yeah, that's... I have seen some people saying that you know, we should have kept them. James, this comes into a wider discussion that we've had multiple times about the formation and what Celtic were trying to do this year. Because at times they were playing the diamond, at times they were playing 4-2-3-1. But it seemed, at the start of the season at least, they were building for a 3-5-2 that never really took any shape because of who they brought in.
This is where my opinions are rank speculation, so I'll caution in advance that this is the case.
And I'll just get the lawyers on the line here. Hang on.
Yeah. Hopefully nothing illegal, or slanderous. But I think that the conception date of the Lennity Frankenstein, as people they've called it Lennity. I call it a Frankenstein because I think it was an unnatural merger. Or attempted merger of the Rodgers ethos of kind of possession-centric controlling of a game and then trying to freshen that up, shall we say, with Lennon's preference for directness and speed and getting forward. And in the 2-0 loss to Rangers towards the end of 18-19 in Lennon's caretaker tenure, the game started in 3-5-2, and that was kind of the first major emergence of that under Lennon in his return. And when we started back then for 19-20, we went through a very very cohesive, understandable recruitment window for a system. And outside of Brown continuing in the role, a misplaced role in the 4-2-3-1, everything else made sense. Every other recruitment piece that window made sense relative to the system we came into the season looking like we were going to play, which is 4-2-3-1/4-3-3. And then, and in fairness to Lennon, Rodgers had problems with Gerard's 4-3-3 system in that last season. even before Rodgers' departure, meaning that the competitions in the two derbies prior to Rodgers leaving were relatively even, even though Rangers had a talent deficit. So my theory is that after the cup final, where we squeaked by and won because of Forster, we won 2-0 at Ibrox in the first derby, but that was really because of a tactical ambush rather than playing a system, where it probably wasn't going to work more than once in the way that Celtic approached that game. And then the 29th of December, where we lost 2-0 at home, to me, what happened was Lennon probably, you know, asserted himself a little more in saying I want to go a different direction. And that's where this game plan of 3-5-2 kind of came in. And we came out of the winter break having installed this as the kind of the primary system. I think that's probably what the game plan was going to be going into the last derby. That was not the last, but what would have probably been the second to last prior to the lockdowns. And then entering the season, that seemed to be what was going to be the game plan, is again making 3-5-2 the priority and the primary system. And that's why I even said it at the time. To me, the Alyanoussi re-signing didn't make any sense, given that likely being the case. Pretty much everyone else in the window does make sense relative to going 3-5-2. Going with Duffy, having a, you know, I don't think he's a good fit, was never a good fit, even within a 3-5-2, but, you know, another high end, let's call it, center back to fill out a three, you know, the idea that you were going to have either Julian, Iyer, or Duffy on the bench, systemically for the season, you know, probably not credible given the amount of money, invested in each of the three. Adjedi, if you're going to sign him, makes more sense as a second striker, you know, kind of as a replacement, quote unquote, for Griffiths rather than a single striker in a 4-2-3-1. You know, the kind of hybrid wing backs that we ended up signing. And then that all falls apart and we kind of go back and forth and it turns into chaotic, incoherent vacillation between systems and them not really understanding or being able to cognitively accept the core of the problems. And they kept trying to tweak things that weren't the problems. They kept trying to solve things through changing systems, swapping out certain people, and they just weren't able to address the core of the problem. And it was basically just shuffling the chairs on the decks of the Titanic. And the recruitment, you know, I 3-5-2 would have been okay with a couple of tweaks. But they didn't make them. They weren't willing to make them. And that introduced all these problems that Alan's talked about. And I'm eventually going to file a copyright for you, Alan, on toxic combinations. and that's basically what ensued, whether it was in 3-5-2, whether it was in 4-2-3-1, is that the style of play relative to the people and the pieces and how they fit together were systemically flawed, regardless of shape. And they never addressed it, except for 9 games. December through, you know, basically November into December, through December into early January. And guess what? The team performed at near the highest level that it performed in the entire, you know, kind of post-Dyla era, for that 9-game run.
Yeah. I remember at the time looking at the team and wondering how a group of professional coaches at any level could not see that playing 3-5-2 with two fullbacks like Laxalt and Frimpong, bombing forward, basically not being back at all, basically playing as wingers, with Brown in the middle working as your legs, and Shane Duffy as the right side of the three at the back, how they didn't see or couldn't see that might have an issue dealing with pace, might have an issue dealing with balls in behind the defense a little bit, because that's what it was. It was almost every time you see Celtic being picked apart over the course of the season, it wasn't some massive build-up play from unbelievable sides. It was three passes and they were through on goal. And you're wondering, how can you get to the level of managing Celtic and not see that that is a fundamental flaw with your team? The result of that is August 26th, beaten by Hungarian side Ferencváros to get knocked out of Champions League, go into the Europa League, and the first derby defeat comes in October, 2-0. Then from that moment on, Celtic lose 3-1 to AC Milan, 4-1 to Sparta Prague twice, lost to Ross County, drew with Hibs, drew with Aberdeen, out of the Europa League, out of the League Cup, out of the Champions League. And by November, the league is essentially over as well. And you're thinking, there must be a turning point at some point. There must be a turning point. They went through that purple patch then where in late, I think it was mid-November to Christmas, they went on an 8-game winning streak, didn't lose a game. And then after Christmas, the first derby defeat happens. Then Dubai happens. And then it's spiraling and spiraling and spiraling. It just keeps getting worse. Let's talk about Dubai, because there's been a lot of post-Dubai discussion, post-league discussion, sort of hindsight discussion around Dubai, especially because of what happened in Georgia Square after the Rangers title win and the destruction caused there and the COVID issues there and the parties with the Rangers players. I don't like to get into a he said, she said debate when it comes to this, because just because Rangers do it does not mean that it was okay for Celtic to do it. Just because Celtic did it does not mean it was okay. It's both wrong. But what Celtic did in Dubai at that period of time where we're no closer to a vaccine, the cases are going crazy after Christmas. There's people still dying at a massive rate in the UK. They're 20 points behind Rangers. They've just lost the derby match, and then they fly off to Dubai, resulting in 13 players being left out of the team, forced out of the team because Christopher Julian tests positive on the way back. So close contacts were considered, and 13 players were missing for 2 games, 2 weeks, and the season's over. So can you surmise that into one answer, Alan, in your opinion of how bad that Dubai was?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't conflate the two incidents that you mentioned. I think there are massive differences. But because, you know, what Celtic did wasn't illegal. It was just enormously misjudged, you know, and misjudge isn't trying to water it down. It killed any remaining momentum that the season may have had, which wasn't a lot by that stage. It was an enormous failure of corporate governance and risk management. To not, as well as on a very fundamental and most importantly, human level, having, you know, the country was just about to enter another extended lockdown, that all the writing was on the cards that was going to happen. That's the way it was moving. You know, the UK government was adamant that people were going to get together for Christmas, but all the signs were that after that it was going to go backwards again. And so, you know, with that mood music, both in the country and, as you mentioned, in terms of the context of how the team were performing, the mood music amongst the support, what everyone was having to deal with, but also just on a practical level, just as a practical level of organising a group of employees to undertake a venture like that in the context of a global pandemic, you'd write off whatever costs you'd accrued on that. And just say, look, guys, not only is this very, very risky, it's actually the wrong thing to do. And we'll just leave it at that. And that's not hindsight. That's what we said at the time. You know, it was the wrong thing to do on all levels, from a corporate responsibility level, from a risk management perspective, and from a human level and a moral level. And as you mentioned, whether we fell upon this from a football perspective, that we fell upon this diamond formation, Soro and Turnbull being introduced, and a coherence where suddenly players like McGregor and Christie were freed up to play roles that they were suited to doing, and Edouard had a partner, and the fullbacks were given a little bit more less rein, I suppose, that all worked and that all made sense. But all that was absolutely thrown out the window by the post Dubai debacle, and Brown came almost straight back into the team as soon as he had a little bit of a knock either side of the new year. But we'd had those two games where we had to field pretty much a completely incoherent, an undeliberate incoherent team, if you know what I mean, and youngsters and so forth, and it just absolutely stopped any momentum dead. And you know what, I don't want to be sort of victim blaming here, but kind of Celtic got the luck that they deserved. I mean, the Scottish government changed the rules sort of almost mid, post Celtic's return flight, which caught 15 people having to isolate. That wasn't Celtic's doing. I mean, you talked about the George Square piece. I mean, the differential between how different football clubs seemingly have been treated throughout this whole COVID crisis is instructive and worthy of further analysis, definitely. But in some respects, Celtic have made their own luck in that respect by making really bad decisions. And guess what? Some of these risks materialized.
Mm. Yeah, I guess my main point on that would be that, you shouldn't have to rely on the rules to know this is a bad decision. It shouldn't come down to whether it was legal. It should come down to, is this the right thing to do based upon football reasons, moral reasons? And the answer was no. I thought it was disgraceful at the time, and I still think it was disgraceful despite what's happened. And I don't care about them. I don't care. it makes no difference to me. I only care about Celtic and what's happening there. James, your thoughts on this? I know you at the time, it was about a risk management situation as well, and the lack of understanding what the risk / sort of result might have been for this.
Yeah. So it was such a moronic decision, because what was the upside? So that we saw what the downside was, and thank goodness it wasn't a super spreader event where or somebody got seriously ill or had myocarditis or something cataclysmic, but it was a pretty bad scenario that unfolded. So I think the obvious question, or should be an obvious question, is, well, what's the upside if everything goes well, right? So forget about even the pathetic PR aspect of it and the terrible decision making relative to the morality of it. But what was the upside that the club was going to enjoy for having done this? And this is where I go back to just ridiculous levels of incompetence, which is, somehow Dubai, quote unquote, worked in the past, that, the team would be go through a renewal as it came back from Dubai. And for a grand total of a sample of two seasons in a row, Rangers suffered and didn't perform well after Celtic had been in Dubai, as if there was some kind of mystic connection between these, and that this Hail Mary was going to be a last attempt to try and do something to save the season and save the 10. Not looking at an analysis of saying, well, Rangers squad depth was inferior to Celtic the last two seasons, and they had a rash of injuries post winter break last season, just normal variance. Al and I have harped on how Rangers have enjoyed positive variance this season and outperformed their XG differential and that type of thing. Well, after the break of Dubai last I have to get used to this now, two seasons ago of 1920, Morelos scored on 0 of 35 shots in the league after Dubai. And that was on an XG per game level that was similar to what Edouard had posted pre-Dubai or pre-winter break for Celtic, which was a good level. I mean, it wasn't as good as afterwards, but we're not talking about Morales playing horribly and not getting in good scoring positions during this period. He just had a really bad stretch of form, bad variance. Those couldn't be reasons. It was because of the mystic connection of the winter training camp in Dubai. That is just so ridiculous, that this level of decision-making was taking place. And then the debacle of how the club managed the process coming back, the you know, the hostage video of Scott Brown, the Peter Lawwell, whatever that was, and then the absolute shit show of Neil Lennon's press conference after having been stuck in his house for 10 days or whatever it was, and then him coming out just wild. And you couldn't write. I mean, this was like Tiger King level of nonsense, like just craziness of incompetence and people just lashing out incoherently. I mean, just crazy. I mean, it deserves a Netflix special, as that's how crazy this was.
Yeah.
And these are the people that are making and this is where the how blowing up situation completely makes sense within this context. Again, if you go start to finish this season, none of this is surprising once you see the feedback loop of just absolute nonsense that went on. And this is what we know. Who knows what's been going on behind the scenes? And I can almost, you know, I can't guarantee anything, but I'd be shocked if there isn't just suitcases of nonsense that we're probably never going to find out, or some of it will find, you know, leak out. Because if this is the stuff that got public, who knows the kind of nonsense that was going on behind the scenes? Because again, you've got people in a hypercharged environment of stress in the middle of a pandemic, living horrible, you know, everyone's been living a horrible form of their life for the last year plus, more so even in Scotland because of the severity of the lockdowns and how extended they've been. So it just, stunning.
Amazon Prime should have done an all or nothing with Celtic rather than Spurs, because this season would have been box office. They actually did. It was the Netflix documentary, the Sunderland one, Sunderland Till I Die, season two. If you watch that, I'd say it reminds me of a lot of actually what you were saying there about what's going on that we don't know about. Like, there's a scene in that where it's transfer deadline day, and Sunderland obviously clearly did not have like a long list of people, but one person they wanted was a striker, and they wanted Will Grigg, and they started their bid at, like, I'll make up the figures, but this is how extreme it got. They started their bid at 1.5 million, say, for example. And the chairman was absolutely not budging beyond 3 million. That's what he said at the start. It gets to the point where there's 2 hours left in the transfer deadline window, and they offer 5 million for Will Grigg, because the chairman was like, just go out and do it. Just like, we haven't planned for this, so just go out and do it. That feels to me what Peter Lawwell and Dermot Desmond, that's what we're not seeing, is that's how the club's been run. That they're like, they were caught so much on the hop with the Brendan Rodgers stuff. They seem to be caught so much on the hop with this Eddie Howe stuff now, that it's just like, how do you, is it a level of naivety? Is it a level of just I don't know, incompetence that's beyond where they're running a club the size of Celtic? It's absolutely crazy. The results of this is that Neil Lennon does get sacked or slash resigns in February after a run of form that just doesn't pick up after the Dubai stuff. Then John Kennedy takes over. There's a whole different layer of Celtic under John Kennedy, but the results are still the same. Rangers go on to win the league. Celtic get knocked out in the Scottish Cup by Rangers in the semi-final. And it actually leads to St. Johnson, oddly, winning the double, which is absolutely fantastic for them, to be fair to them. But let's talk about external factors and what potentially might have caused this, because as bad as Celtic are, I don't believe, and I don't think anybody on this podcast believes, that Rangers are as far ahead as they are in the league table and in points tally. So let's talk about the uncontrollable external factors that affected the season. So I guess Rangers are going to play a large chunk of this, or role, a large role in this, Alan, in terms of the external uncontrollables that they were overachieving essentially this season.
Yeah, I think, again, listen, before anyone gets too selective with quoting me on this, is that, you know, Celtic have been absolutely, the reason Celtic are in this position is because of Celtic and Celtic people. And to your point, although we can't know the individual motivators of people, what is the most obvious answer? The most obvious answer is that, you know, hubris, arrogance, complacency are all well-documented outcomes from prolonged periods of success. And eventually those factors that I've just mentioned take over, because what you did 9 years ago when you started to win, you think you just need to repeat that. And as James said, we got to Dubai because we did it last year and it worked, rather than thinking about what is right for us to do today. So that's I think really what it is. But as we know, football is a game massively influenced by fortune. It's and it's a game where, especially this season more than any, there have been so many external variables at play, and Celtic have not deserved, have not performed in a way that they deserve the rub of the green or the brick of the ball, and they certainly haven't had it in any shape or form. And you know, on the other side of the city, where you've had a very well organised, well recruited, well coached side, you know, the opposite I think has been the case. It's not the most important factor, because as I say, it is the incompetence and incoherence of the way Celtic were set up, recruited for, and put out on the pitch that was the main factor. But if you look at, for example, just injuries, I mentioned this before. I don't think people mention enough the impact of not having Christopher Julian for the majority of the season. I mean, he was Celtic's most experienced and capable defender as a pure out-and-out defender. He was the leader of the defence, and to lose him and Forster has been a massive blow. You know, I think Forrest was probably less serious in terms of the way that the team played, but nevertheless, again, he was probably integral to that 3-5-2 potentially that never ever came to fruition this season, or very rarely came to fruition at all. If you look at number of matches lost to injury over the season, and I think I stopped counting maybe 10 games before the end of the season, but then by that stage, the season had long finished in terms of materiality. I think Celtic lost 198 matches worth of players. So 198 appearances that first team players could have played. And that was across something like 16 different individuals over the season. Whereas for the Rangers, it was 125, I think. So quite a significant difference in matches lost to injury in that extent. And also the key personnel, and as I say, especially Julian. That probably had an impact. What did it make the difference in the season? No, I don't think it did, but it certainly didn't help. You look at other externals. We've mentioned expected goals. I mean, the expected goals differential. I mean, Celtic actually were on the right side of fortune, if you want to put it that way, for expected goals. They scored 78. Their expected goals in the league was 78. So they scored pretty much at the rate you'd expect them to. But they conceded, I think, something like 29 goals in the SPFL. But their expected goals against in the SPFL Celtic was 40. That's how poor Celtic's defence was. So we actually kind of got away with it a little bit defensively. If you look at the Rangers' equivalence, theirs is insane. It's something like 92 goals. Again, I'm sorry, I'm not being precise. But their expected goals are something like 68. It's just like insane. And then I think they conceded something like 12, 15, or 15 goals. Their expected goals against was something like 25 or something like that. So there's nearly a 40 goal swing in expected goals. So again, these things do matter. And are they sustainable? Probably not over a long period. Not that enormous gulf in between expected. So again, I'm using that as these are just facts, right? I'm not saying that's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just the way it was. And then the final piece of, I suppose, there's the whole, again, we touched on it really, the whole COVID impacts. And Celtic had significant COVID impacts. You know, the Bolingoli, the Bolingoli breach at the beginning of the season, the fact that Christie was taken out of a derby game, and he room shared with Tierney, who wasn't taken out of Arsenal's next fixture. You know, the whole Dubai thing. Players coming back from international duty, Bitton, there was a few, El Hamid, having to isolate as well. And then the punishments, or, you know, the games that were lost, the postponements that were had, and you contrast that, you know, to the almost lack of COVID impacts, and it's again that would have had an impact. It was an external factor. It seemed to impact one side more than others. These all sound like excuses. Like I say, the most important fact was we were rubbish, and we got exactly what we deserved. But all of these factors will serve to make the gulf look enormous. And I think what we're saying is we deserve to lose, but is the gulf as big as it looked? It probably isn't.
Yeah, I guess what we're getting at here is not trying to make excuses for the season, because essentially what it is that you know, Celtic were shit. But James, the idea that Rangers are going to be finishing 22 points ahead, 23 points ahead of Celtic next season because of, listen, we'll pretend that everything's okay at Celtic and it's not going to be another mess, but the idea that they're going to be so far ahead because of the large chunk of data that we now know, that analyzing that shows that they were probably overperforming this year and they won't be as good next year unless they, again, have another incredibly lucky season in the terms of overachieving. I don't mean they were lucky to win the league. I just mean they were lucky in the sense that they were overachieving to their XG.
Yeah, this is not about excuse making. This is about analyzing and trying to think about things from a probabilistic perspective. So how do we diagnose what happened, why, and then what does it try to help us in thinking about what the future might entail? And the same process that I used that led me to the conclusion that Rangers were a lot closer to Celtic than the 13 points that was in the table, the gap when the league was called, leads me to believe that 25 is nowhere near as reflective. You know, 13 was way too wide relative to underlying performance. And you know, this is where we stress measuring performance levels is, particularly in football, is completely different than results. And that the disparities there can be dramatic over even season, even two seasons. Depending on what's going on and why. So, for example, the idea that Lennon's team in 1920 performed significantly better than Rogers' invincible side in 16-17, I would argue it was a better team. Mm. We had better players overall, I think. The wage bill was higher. So I think Rangers actually performed better last season. The XG differentials certainly support that by a large margin. Like, it's not even close. Rangers performed really well in 1920, and they enjoyed a lot of positive variance this season. So again, that it just happens. Was there an inordinate amount of it this season, this past season for Rangers? Yes, like a rare level, as Alan said. If you look at their expected points, right? So it's just, it's probabilities. It's a measurement tool. It's not to say that it could have or should have. It's strictly trying to measure things relative to variance. Rangers are about 3 points better than Celtic this season, even with all of the mess that Celtic had. And that was because Rangers had, you know, that stretch from right before they lost in the League Cup to Ross County through the end of the season. They didn't drop any significant points in the league, but that was very lucky. They just in any other season, the vast majority of the time, if you just run Monte Carlo simulation of XG differentials, they probably, you know, the vast majority of the time you're going to have a team that puts up those kind of differentials drop maybe 10, 12 more points than they did. So again, that's not saying that they wouldn't have won the league by a lot or that they were undeserving of it. It's you know, a game like Hamilton where they got a draw, where Hamilton, I think, was well over one in outperforming them in XG. Now, again, some of this is to their credit. They, you know, they had Alan McGregor. They made the decision to bring him back, and he's a difference maker like a Forster in you know, winning points. You know, one of the things that I think I was the first person to break this story, even before the journalists did, was that relative to injuries, they invested in a machine learning software package called Zone 7 AI back in September. That's when I found out about it. And I also heard that Celtic looked at it and decided not to use it and license it. And if you look at the clubs that have used this software, their soft tissue injuries have gone down like 80%. That is a decision that Rangers made. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't luck that they had their injuries drop as much as they did, soft tissue. And again, I think Ryan Jack, it hasn't been made public. I'm guessing Ryan Jack probably had like a meniscus problem. You know, when you have trauma injuries like, you know, Julian did, you're not going to prevent a guy, you know, when he rams his knee into a pipe at velocity, you know, but we're talking about day-to-day fitness regimes, managing workloads and customizing it based off of each player, and using machine learning to do that. I mean, that really sophisticated stuff. Well, you know, they did it and we didn't. And mm-hmm. the output was, well, they had a lot more healthy players, and performing at elite levels relative to their athleticism. That was a decision they made. So is that an arbitrage that could get them to outperform their XG, right? XG is not all encompassing. XG is not determinative. It's a tool. And I fully believe that, you know, this is a debate. But my understanding of analytics and is that, you know, there are ways to outperform. There are ways to systematically beat something like XG, I believe. But whether it's because of talent, a premium talent versus the opposition level, or some of these other things like having fitter players, having players that can run faster for longer because they're training better, those types of things, whether as it you know, Rangers did, or you know, in other sports you've seen PEDs enable these kinds of things. So there are ways to kind of beat the system, so to speak, both fairly and unfairly. So I could see a scenario where Roy Keane becomes the manager for Celtic if they keep the wage bill relatively steady and do an okay job on recruitment, where Celtic, you know, lose the league by 5 points next season. Does that mean that it's a quote unquote better team, or that they performed better than, and Rangers could perform better next season and not earn 102 points.
Yeah.
They could perform better next season in underlying metrics and win the league with 90 points. Right. So these are the kinds of things that, this is why we look at these measurements and tools and why analytics is its own domain. I mean, that you just can't look at these stats and say, oh, well, this means the obvious linear, you know, so it's putting together a mosaic and trying to really understand what's going on. I fully expect Rangers' underlying performance metrics to get better next season, meaning that they didn't have a great year relative to XG differential, generally speaking. So I'd be surprised if they don't get better. I'd be surprised if Celtic doesn't get better for all the reasons that we've talked about. Now, what the relative equation there is between those two is highly uncertain because there's so much uncertainty on the Celtic side right now, including what the wage bill is going to be, which I would say is primary, which is where this Hal debacle could be even a bigger risk. And then you have all this other stuff. This is completely uncontrollable, which people hate to try and think about and conceptualize, which is just luck, variance, all these other things. I mean, it season by season, they have a huge impact on who wins a league. And that'll be the case next season as well.
Yeah. We're not saying that they didn't deserve to win it this year. What we're saying is this repeatable? And the probability would say it's probably not repeatable in the same manner that they did it, depending on how the rest of it. But the main thing I would say is that Celtic need to control the controllables, and that
was my criticism all season, which is there were so many uncontrollable risks heightened this season because of COVID, because of the pandemic, because of a bunch of important players in the last, you know, entering the last year of their contract. Mm-hmm. Because it being the 10 in a row, and if the club didn't win the season, right, there's all of these things that entering the season were uncontrollable, and then to pour lighter fluid on top of them, and then to throw a match into it at various points, willfully, was crazy.
I mean, this is you'd like to think, although today me changing my parameters, you'd like to think last season was almost the worst version of Celtic you're going to see. And add into that, as James said, all of the variance is not going your way on top of that. And versus an opponent who, you know, I think is possibly the best version of they can be. You know, their form in Europe, their form in the SPFL was fantastic. They got the results they deserved in the SPFL. Can they repeat that? Can they maintain that standard? What other pressures are there to come to bear? Can they get the positive variance? So I think that would be my take on it. What the outcome would be next season, I couldn't possibly say, but I would be surprised if it was as wide as it was this season. But hey ho, that'll come back to haunt me.
Yeah, we shall see. We shall see. And hopefully, again, I'm wrapping another podcast by saying, hopefully we will know who our manager is in the next couple of weeks, and we'll do a podcast then. So that was the season wrap from the Huddle Breakdown. As you can see, we're a bit flustered because of the news today, so I don't know, hopefully we might have some news next week to talk about, and we might actually continue on this podcast, and by the time that a manager arrives, we'll be into a brand new season. So we shall see. I do want to give a big thank you to James and to Alan for joining me for the podcast this year, and of course a massive thank you to everybody who has listened, subscribed, watched, tweeted us, sent in questions all throughout the year. It's been an absolute blast doing this podcast for the last season. I know we didn't do it from the very start, but the reception and the kind words that everyone has sent in has been absolutely phenomenal. So a big thank you to everyone who has listened over the course of the season. We will be back next season for another season of Celtic breakdowns and performance analysis and wondering what the hell we're going to do with our lives because Celtic are ruining it for us. Hopefully it'll be a little bit more cheery next year. James, my thanks to you. Alan, my thanks to you.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, we'll chat to you next season.
Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.